No, I don't think so.
It was a painful moment. Her look said it all. She shouldn't have asked, because how the hell would he know?
Actually, she's going to college in just a few more weeks, he said.
She asked about his mother and Helen. He realized she hadn't asked him what he was doing now. People who knew him never did. She asked if he was still at his mother's.
Temporarily,
he said. For the last 10 years. After she left, Rini said he had to close for a while. He had a headache and his stomach was upset. Rini followed him to the door, and Sam asked again if he could borrow a buck. Rini took out his wallet that was so worn it had been taped together on the fold. Even the dollar he gave him was thin and frayed.
Hey, thanks, Rini,
he said with a flick of the bill. Then, seeing the misery in Rini's expression, he turned back and asked what was wrong.
Nothing,
Rini said.
You think I'm going to go get a drink with this, right?
No, I wasn't thinking that.
Well, what are you thinking?
It's a business thing, Rini said. He shrugged and shook his head, and now Sam realized it was the cat. Rini was afraid he'd tell Helen about the cat. Well, if that was it, he wanted Rini to know the secret was safe with him. Rini nodded, then looked up at him.
You know what you said once about riddles being buried under the tomatoes?
Sam pointed to himself.
I said that? Me? No, I'm like you. I don't know what could have happened to him.
You think he ran away? Rini watched him closely.
Maybe. I don't know. Maybe he got lost. You know, maybe he took a wrong turn or something and he got confused. Like when you found him, right? He was lost then.
He wasn't lost. Rini looked at him sheepishly.
I just said that. I got him off this lady that came in the store. Her husband died, and she said the dog was always howling. He was so lonesome. She was going to put him to sleep, so I said I'd take him.
A little grin came over his face.
And right off the bat, he liked me, just like he did her husband. She told me that. So I know he didn't run away. I don't know. It's just one of those things, I guess.
Maybe somebody stole him, Rini said hesitantly.
Well, there you go. That's probably what happened.
Yeah. And sometimes I think I hear him, you know. I get up in the middle of the night and I go out on the porch to see if it's him.
Yeah, well, who knows, Rini? One of these nights he'll probably be scratching on the door and Helen'll start yelling, "That dog's ripping my screen." And then Bridget'll start barking back at him again and it'll be just like it used to be.
I hope so, Rini said. In Joey's absence, a rotted corner post of the popcorn stand had been yanked out, and the roof edge was sagging, lifting at times like a tent flap in the wind. One night, all the stacked wooden cases for empty cans and bottles had been toppled by raccoons or vandals, and so they had been hauled away by a town crew. And now, Joey had a competitor. He was a pleasant young man who sold popcorn, soda, footlong hot dogs, and French fries out of the side of an old school bus that had been painted red, white, and blue. The beauty of this arrangement was that the bus would be there only during the band concerts. By day, the park would be non-commercial, that is, as soon as the alderman could get rid of the old man's ramshackle stand. No one was more disappointed than Chief Stoner when Joey returned to his stand just 2 days after leaving the hospital. Retirement would have been a more gracious ending than the eviction that even some of Joey's oldest sympathizers were considering. In the way that inexplicable events are often diabolized, the mugging had come to be regarded as almost inevitable. Once again, Joey Selden had crossed paths with violence. Oddly, the town's indignation was less over the old man's suffering than it was over the defiant swagger of Blue Mooney. Fired from J.C. Coulter, he now spent his days racing his motorcycle up and down the winding mountain roads and his bitter nights roaring through Atkinson's sleeping streets. There had been 3 more burglaries in the last 2 weeks, and now Jerry Coughlin was convinced his restaurant was next on Mooney's list. He'd banned Mooney from the A+X, which came as a great relief to Alice Vermoyle. The police, in an effort to monitor Mooney's activities, began to sit in a cruiser parked at the end of the road that led up to his mother's cottage. Her young customers had stopped coming. Just as she'd predicted, her son's presence was harming her family. So with the old man back in the park selling popcorn, it was a bittersweet time for Sonny. For Carol's sake, he and Eunice had tried being friends, but it was impossible. Without love's flattering veil, she'd become the same loud, brash, irresponsible Eunice Bonifant who'd always grated on his nerves. He had begun to understand how connected people were. The old judge had known it. His father had known it. It amazed him that he'd veered so drastically off course. He went home every 2.5 hours to give Carol her medication and spend a few minutes visiting with her. He had reinstituted the weekly firearm inspection. He filled the jugs in the fallout shelter with fresh water. He took the police radio out of the house and returned it to the station. He hired 2 shifts of nurses and insisted that Lester get out and have some fun. "Call Alice," he told him. Lester said she wouldn't talk to him. "Then go meet another girl," he said, relieved not that he'd thought she was a bad influence on Les, but she certainly couldn't have been a positive one, not with all her family's troubles. One day, Lester went to the rectory and asked to speak with Father Gannon. He said he finally understood his life's calling. He wanted to be a priest. Father Gannon advised him to wait until he was older, until he'd experienced life a little more. Shocked and disappointed, Lester made an appointment with the Monsignor, who put Lester in immediate contact with a pious young seminary counselor in St. Albans. The Monsignor leaned across his desk and told Father Gannon that he was never, ever to give such twisted advice to a young man again. The office door slammed. The kitchen door slammed. Howard looked up from the hedge he was trimming to see Father Gannon sit down on the steps and light a cigarette. Howard had never smoked. He liked the smell of cigarette smoke, but no one else did, especially not the Monsignor, who had banned the unpriestly habit from his rectory.
"So how was your trip to see Purda?"
Father Gannon asked, rolling the perfect white ash off his cigarette.
"It was okay,"
Howard said, pleased that Father had remembered his cousin's name. Most people couldn't even remember Howard's name.
"How'd Miss Brastis like the trip? You two have fun together?" "She didn't like it too much."
Howard's voice quavered. He wished he'd never told Father Gannon about Lucille. He lowered his head to the angle of shrubbery he continued to clip. It hurt to talk about it. Actually, Lucille had said it was the worst time of her life.
"How come?" "Too depressing there," she said.
"Really?
Well, where does Purda live?"
"Waterbury,"
Howard said.
"Waterbury."
He took a long drag on his cigarette, all the while peering down at Howard.
"You mean the state mental hospital?"
"Yeah, that's where Purda lives. She's got the mind of a baby."
"Howard, that's not where you go on a first date."
He couldn't tell if Father Gannon was surprised or amused.
"It wasn't a date. Me and Josiah always used to go see Purda."
"I know, but with Miss Brastis, it was a date."
"It was?"
"Of course. Now you have to make it up to her. You have to take her on a real date."
"I do?"
"Yes, Howard. To a movie or out dancing. Women like that. They want to be fussed over. They like to get all dressed up and go somewhere nice, not to a mental institution."
Father Gannon got up and ground out his cigarette.
"Ask her. You'll see."
The tender branch tips fluttered to the grass as Howard's clippers scissored along the hedge. He didn't think he could do that. Besides, she and him hadn't spoken a word since the bus back late that night when he'd tried to give her the extra plastic paperweight he'd saved for her. It was the prettiest one. Inside was a yellow flower that sprayed red droplets through the water when it was shaken.
"No, thank you," she'd said. "I think Purda would enjoy it a lot more than me."
Late in the afternoon, Mr. Briscoe came into Marie's office. He sat on the edge of Astrid's desk, his legs outstretched and rigid, his arms folded. He seemed so ill at ease that for a moment Marie thought he'd come in to fire her. But, of course, he couldn't very well do that now that Astrid had quit. This morning Marie had been a half hour late for work, and then, in her haste to make up for it, she had messed up his biggest ski boot order, which was going to mean a 6-week delay in delivery. Omar had shown up at 10:30 last night, his trunk and back seat a jumble of boxes and bottles of detergent that he'd managed to talk the Presto shipping clerk into letting him take early. Thinking it was her shipment, she told Benji to help him carry it into the kitchen so she could get a head start on attaching the promotional pamphlets. But then Omar said she could only take 6 of each.
"A good faith delivery,"
he called it, just enough to give her the feel of the product. The rest had to be parceled out among his other distributors. She couldn't believe it. She had paid $1,000 for that?
she asked, pointing. 6 bottles and 6 boxes?
Your sarcasm is falling on deaf ears, Marie. I'm too tired.
Omar had sighed, fanning himself with one of the shiny brochures. Sarcasm? Sarcasm? Dry shock! She'd shouted, as he hurried out to his car, then drove off. Mr. Briscoe was having a hard time getting to the point. His employees' financial matters were their own affair, and he never interfered, but he was so stunned by what Cleveland Hines had just told him on the phone that he felt obligated to speak to her. The gray, lightless space pulled closer around them. Was it true, Mr. Briscoe was asking, that she had borrowed a substantial amount of money from the Atkinson Savings Bank and had not only missed the first payment, but had made no attempt to discuss the situation with Cleveland Hines? What could she say? That she thought someone had paid it for her? That Omar had assured her he would take care of it, had promised he would? Her hands wouldn't stop shaking. The kids were right. Every word out of his mouth was a lie. Reenie was polishing stovetops with a special cream. It smelled of pine needles. He reached up and dabbed some across his throat, then rubbed it in. His clothes reeked of last night's dinner, vinegary tripe. Bending over his reflection in the gleaming enamel, he wet his fingers and pressed his bushy eyebrows smooth. But nothing was working. Nothing made him feel any better.
"Hello, my esteemed brother Elk," boomed a voice over the bells on the opening door.
He turned to see Cleveland Hines.
"With all the publicity you've been getting, I figured you'd be in Hollywood or something by now."
"How are you doing, Mr. Hines?" Reenie said, as Hines pumped his hand heartily.
Oh, to be able to shake a man's hand like that, he thought, to have such exuberance, such confidence.
"Busier than hell, Reenie. Busier than hell," he sighed,
removing his straw hat.
"That's good," Reenie said.
Hines ran his hand over the stove, streaking it. He turned a few buttons, opened the oven door, and peered inside. Reenie's heart fluttered. It was the deluxe model.
"Automatic timer and shut off," he said, growing short of breath. "Put in a roast, play 18 holes, and it's ready when you're ready. And this plug here's for the automatic coffee."
He plugged in the pot that came with the stove. He hoped he remembered all the features. He felt dizzy.
"Put in your ground coffee, set it for a half hour before you want to wake up in the morning, and not only does it start itself and perk a wonderful pot of coffee, but it wakes you up to beautiful music."
He twirled a dial, then smiled up at Hines as the William Tell overture jumped from the console. Hines took a monogrammed handkerchief from his pocket and wiped his brow.
"Listen, Reenie, I hate to bother you. I don't want to take up too much of your time," he said.
"No bother, Mr. Hines. Actually, this particular model sells itself," Reenie said, straightening up, "once people get over the first shock of the cost."
"The thing is, Reenie, there's a matter that needs discussion. It's rather delicate."
Reenie took a deep breath and reached for his wallet. He'd just give him the money back for his wife's toaster.
"Toaster? What toaster?"
Hines said, looking around. And then Reenie understood. The bank owned this building, and they were probably mad about the paint job. He knew he should have asked them first, and now that it looked so good, they were probably going to raise his rent. Maybe they'd found out about the cat. Well, he wasn't going to get rid of Tom, no sir. He scrubbed Mr. Hines's fingerprints off the stovetop. They'd have to kick him and Tom both out. Hines held the handkerchief to his temple. He spoke slowly, wincing as if the words hurt.
"I shouldn't be telling you this. It's of such a confidential nature, but it's been bothering the hell out of me. It's Marie Vermoyle, your sister-in-law. Well, former sister-in-law. She came in a while back for a loan. Now, as you know, Reenie, we're a conservative institution, and with her situation being what it is, I had to say no."
He nodded, though he had no idea what Hines was getting at.
"But then, because of you, Reenie, because I wanted to do the right thing by a fellow brother Elk, I said okay."
His eyes shot into Reenie's.
"Well, didn't she get mad as hell and right up on her high horse? Something about a washing machine and how every time it broke down you charged her for repairs?"
"I gave her the machine at cost," he said, "and I only ever charged for parts what it cost me. I'd never try and make a dime off Marie and those kids, their family."
Hines held up his hand.
"I know that, Reenie. You don't have to tell me. I'm just trying to give you the whole story here so you'll see what a mess we've got on our hands, you and me."
"Mess?"
"You co-signed that note, Reenie."
You didn't want Helen to know, remember?
Reeny shook his head. At the time, Helen and Bridget had told Marie the only way they would ever help her was if she took Sam back and dropped the divorce proceedings. Co-signing Marie's note behind their backs had been the most daring deed of his life. Nothing before or since had ever made him feel so powerful and so good. But then he'd ruined it by acting like a fool that night with the turkey, and Marie had despised him ever since.
To make a long story short, if she can't make the payments, then we have no choice but to sue and put an attachment on the house.
Cleveland Hines wet his lips.
And, of course, now with your name on the new loan, and she hasn't even made the first payment. Well, that's why I'm here, Reeny, to see what you intend to do about this.
Me? I never signed for any new loan.
Well, it's right here,
Hines said, unfolding a thick document on the stovetop.
That's not my name, Reeny said.
Hines looked at it.
Of course it's your name.
I mean, how I write my signature, Reeny cried. Somebody else wrote my name on that, not me.
Wait a minute now, just wait a minute,
Hines puffed as he flipped back through the typewritten pages.
Oh, my Lord,
he groaned, laying two forms side by side to compare signatures.
You're right,
he looked up.
She forged your name. She falsified a bank document, a legal instrument of commerce. She could go to jail for this. She should go to jail, that little.
But when she signed my name, how come you didn't say anything?
Reeny asked, puzzled. Hines cleared his throat, explaining how he hadn't actually seen the signing because he'd trusted Marie and given her the note to bring here to Reeny.
Of course, now I know I never should have let her take the instrument from the bank, but to be honest, in a small town, things like this happen all the time in banking. You bend the rules, you go around corners, you try to help people. In the long run, it's usually good business.
Hines was pacing back and forth.
And damn it, I should have known the way she was so nervous and shaky when she signed.
Hines waved his hand in disgust.
I'm sorry, Reeny, this is my fault. I'll just let the chief take over now and let the chips fall where they may.
How much is the loan for?
Reeny asked.
$1,000,
Hines choked out the words.
If you got a pen, I'll sign the loan.
Hines looked at him.
Are you serious, Reeny?
Yeah. I don't want Marie going to jail. Do you?
No. God, no.
Hines had given him a pen. He bent over the stove, startled by the cold metal against his belly as he signed his name.
Believe me, Reeny, I won't forget this,
Hines said, folding the document. He sighed.
Of course, we've still got the problem of the late payment.
Reeny stared at him.
We?
He didn't know what to say.
I'll tell you what, Hines said with a wave of dismissal. I'll call her. We'll see what she says.
Hines patted his shoulder.
I'm going way out on the limb here, but we'll work this out.
I appreciate it,
Reeny said.
Well, I know you do,
Hines said.
You've always been good to me, Mr. Hines, like the loan for all the fans last year.
He smiled, expecting praise for paying that loan off in half the time.
And the tax money,
Hines reminded him.
Most of all that,
Reeny said, his stomach suddenly churning with the sense that it might all be connected. Co-signing the mortgage and the humiliating audit with the IRS had both happened the same year he won the turkey at the Elks Christmas raffle and brought it to Marie's house. It was late, and he'd been drinking. He remembered her standing in the doorway in her pajamas, looking grateful and confused. She told him how her father had always brought the turkey home the night before Christmas. In the snowy darkness, a wild joy had risen in him, and he'd staggered closer, seizing her arms and pressing his mouth over hers. She had pushed him down the steps and sworn at him as he ran to his car. Could it have been her, he wondered, Marie Vermoyle, who had turned him into the IRS? She'd probably collected some kind of a reward, blood money, off the one person who cared for her.
You're a good man, Reeny,
Hines said, with an even more vigorous shake of his hand.
A real solid citizen.
No, I'm not,
he thought as he watched Hines head down the sidewalk, tipping his hat to the ladies and stopping to shake eager hands all along the bright, busy street. The next day, Marie stood at her kitchen counter, jaw clenched as she tenderized a chuck steak with a wooden mallet, the red, fleshy whack, 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 grimly satisfying. Norm sat at the table telling her and Benji about the trouble in the park today. It had started with a couple of kids leaning on Joey's stand, and Joey warning them to get away before it collapsed. When a few more kids came and began to taunt him by deliberately shaking the stand, Joey started hurling soda bottles and cans at them. Some of the bottles smashed on the sidewalk, and then when the kids tried to sneak up behind him, he'd turned and thrown more bottles at them as they fled across West Street. Some of the bottles smashed in the road, and one even dented the hood of a woman's car.
"What a mess," Norm said. "Greeny sent a crew up, and they had to stop traffic so we could broom all the broken glass. And then Chief Stoner came, and he was talking to Joey and trying to get him to go home in the cruiser, but Joey refused."
"That poor man," she said, flipping over the steak to pound the other side. "That's what happens. The minute you're down, the slightest crack they see, they're all over you."
She knew by their silence they were probably exchanging glances. Let them. Someday they'd know. When the dogs were nipping at their heels, then they'd understand all she'd been through for them. Once again, she thought of that goddamn Cleveland Hines calling Mr. Briscoe about her loan.
And that goddamn Omar and goddamn Sam, all the no-good goddamn bastards,
beat the rhythm of the pounding mallet. There wasn't any kindness in this life. None. None at all.
"Joey said they'd have to arrest him to make him leave, that he was only trying to protect his property," Norm said. "And then this lady that lives by the park starts screaming that it's not his property, that he's nothing but a charity case, and she's sick of having to see that shack out her front window 12 months a year. And maybe everybody else was afraid to speak up, but she wasn't."
"Wow," Benji said. "Sounds like a show or something." "Bastards," she said, pounding the meat, pounding it and pounding it.
"Mom, Mom," Norm said, tapping her shoulder. "Someone's here."
She spun around, shocked to see Cleveland Hines in the back doorway. She hadn't heard him knocking.
"Hello, Marie,"
Hines said with a smile.
"What do you want?"
She almost hadn't gotten that out. The nerve of him, coming here after he'd called Mr. Briscoe.
"Well, I was on my way home, and I was going by here."
"It's a dead-end street," she said.
"Well, in a manner of speaking, going by. In any event, I thought I'd stop by and see how the repairs are coming along."
He glanced up at the stained ceiling, then down at the cracked floor tiles.
"Norm," she said, conscious of her son's rapt attention, "I need milk."
She pressed the money into his hand and told him to take Benji with him.
"Go,"
she ordered, as he stood there staring at her.
"Now?"
They kept looking back as they headed out the door.
"Nice looking boys,"
Hines said, loosening his tie and undoing his collar button. He stood by the table, smiling at her.
"I'm glad you sent them on an errand. This way we can talk," he said, sitting down at the table.
She remained standing.
"How could you come here? How do you have the nerve after what you did?"
"What I did?"
he asked.
"Calling my boss, discussing my business with Mr. Briscoe. You had no right to do that. You could have called me."
He closed his eyes with a sigh, then told her he had taken the liberty of speaking to Mr. Briscoe because he cared about what happened here, and he hoped he might save her any future embarrassment. He took out a cigarette and lit it.
"You care so much? Then maybe I should take the liberty of speaking to Mrs. Hines to save her any future embarrassment."
She banged the table, startled to see her hand and wrist speckled with bits of raw meat and blood.
"I'm shocked,"
he said, gulping on the smoke he'd just inhaled. His eyes watered.
"Shocked that you'd say such a thing, especially under the circumstances."
He kept clearing his throat.
"You may not think so, but what you did is a crime."
"What?"
She sagged back against the counter.
"What are you talking about?"
"I'm talking about signing Reenie's name on the note. That's forgery, Marie," he said.
She opened her mouth, but for a moment couldn't speak. This wasn't happening. She hadn't done such a thing, had she? Had she? She had tried too hard for too long to be strong, and now she would pay. Merciless, they would swoop down one by one, pecking, nicking her battered hide until she bled, until she could only crawl, until there was nothing left.
"Marie, Marie, listen. I'm sure we can work this out."
He got up and stood close to her.
"There are ways and ways of meeting one's obligations. But the most important thing is that we don't stop communicating." "Listen, Marie,"
he crooned as she stared up at him.
"We've got to talk about this, so why don't we meet sometime next week? Oh,
in some quiet, non-business setting where the two of us can move this thing back and forth a little. And that way I know what's going on in your life, and you'll feel more comfortable dealing with me. What say?
He flashed a grin.
Tuesday? Wednesday? Let's make it Thursday night, 7-ish. We can meet at the...
What do you want? She demanded. Tell me what you want me to do.
It's what I don't want, Marie. I don't want to see you in trouble over this. Our connection goes too far back.
What are you talking about? We have no connection.
Well, you know, Sam, Nora, he grinned. You know what I mean.
Get out! Her hand moved to the mallet. Get out before my sons come back!
It was the next morning, and Omar Duval lay in Bernadette's bedroom. The thin plastic window shade sagged with heat. In the other room, Bernadette and her daughters were singing Itsy Bitsy Spider as she dressed them in bathing suits. The paper sack by the front door contained sandwiches and Kool-Aid she'd made for their day at the lake. He didn't want to go, but it was a promise he'd already broken twice. At the screech of the little girl's laughter, he shuddered. His legs ached and his heart was sore, actually tender now as he touched his breast. Each time Roy Gold had promised delivery, he'd come away not only believing, but inflamed, inspired, convinced that it was only a matter of time before the soap came. It wasn't enough just to impress Gold. He wanted to dazzle him, and so he had invested most of his distributor's money and his own. He wanted to be the best franchise supervisor Gold had. He had sold 34 franchises, with just about every cent of it going to Gold. And now the man wouldn't see him, wouldn't take his calls. His last trip to Westport, he had to sleep in his car and slip out on diner tabs, and all he'd come away with was a car full of battered bottles and dented soap boxes, which he had begged from a warehouse worker.
"Is it because you're so swamped with orders?" Omar had asked, blowing dust off a bottle.
"Nah," the worker had scoffed. "Just one of them cease-and-desist deals. They come shut everything down. A few weeks go by, and we start up again."
How had this happened, he wondered. A few weeks. Everywhere he went, people wanted their soap. None more desperate now than Marie. Last night, when he tried to make her see how bad things were, when he needed to confide in someone, she'd thrown him out of her house. She was giving him 24 hours to either return her money or deliver her soap, or else she was going to go to the police. He rose up on his elbows, clutching his chest. His pain wasn't fear of the police, but his dread of having to move on again, a life of running and hiding, curled up to sleep on the front seat. These last few days he had been racked with hungers that food and comfort could no longer assuage. The worst deprivation would be losing Marie. Bernadette's and her daughter's giddy voices rose against the door.
"We're ready,"
she cried, throwing it open. They were dressed in bright bathing suits with bright beach towels over their arms, their smiles so eager, so voracious, that he felt sick to his stomach. He hurried into the bathroom, where he splashed water on his unshaven face. As he reached for a towel, he noticed the sparkle of light from the toothpaste-smeared shelf over the sink. He slipped the ring onto his pinky finger and stepped closer to the window to examine the tiny diamond in the light. When he came out of the bathroom, he told Bernadette that he didn't feel up to going.
"Tough shit," she growled. "You promised, and that's all there is to it."
"But I have this pain,"
he said, wincing as he probed the tenderness in his chest.
"I don't care if you're having a fucking heart attack. They think they're going swimming, and that's where they're going."
They waited by the door with their sand pails and plastic boats, watching as hard-eyed as their mother as he buttoned his shirt. He bent to tie his shoes, and pain shot down his arms to his fingertips.
"You're going like that?"
Bernadette asked, pointing as he put on his rumpled suit jacket.
"It's all I have."
"I have to go to the bathroom,"
Noelle cried, legs crossed and squirming.
"Then go,"
Bernadette said, and Noelle ran into the bathroom.
"I can't,"
the child cried.
"I'm tied." "Help her,"
Bernadette ordered the older girl. "Untie her bathing suit." Mary ran into the bathroom.
"What are you going to do? Sit on the beach in your suit all day?"
she asked, setting down the bulging grocery bag.
"There must be something of Kyle's that'd fit you," she said, hurrying into the bedroom.
In the bathroom, the little girls' voices rose querulously. Bernadette returned with a pair of red plaid shorts.
"Come on,"
she called, opening the bathroom door to find Mary kicking towels through the yellow puddle on the floor.
God damn it!
Bernadette cried, shaking Noelle, who was patting dry her wet bathing suit and dripping legs with a washcloth. Bernadette grabbed the washcloth and wet it in the sink, then knelt to scrub the sobbing child's plump legs. Her head shot up, and then she stood suddenly, gripping the grimy glass shelf. Her cry of loss had an oddly soothing effect on Omar. The pain was gone. He felt stronger, more confident. So here it was, another impulsive action now so imbued with plausibility that he understood with perfect clarity and unshakable faith its purpose.
"You bastard! You little bastard!" she cried, shaking one child and slapping the other. "What did you do with it? What did you do with my ring, my beautiful diamond ring?"
"Nothing! Honest, Mommy!"
"It's down here, isn't it?"
She clutched the chipped rim with both hands, grunting and pulling as if to tear the sink from the wall.
"You dropped it down the sink! My future! My whole life!"
"Now, Bernadette," he said softly. "They're children. They meant no harm."
It was early evening. Marie's car was gone, and her house was locked. Omar cupped his hands to his eyes and peered through the dusty windows. The television was off, and the table was set for three. He came around the back of the house, wading through the tall grass. On the clothesline, which had begun to sag again, the clothes were already dry. As he unpinned them, he began to worry that she might have done something as reckless as driving to Westport for a personal confrontation with Roy Gold. Yes, she was just that impetuous and headstrong. He paused with a stiff towel bunched at his chest as he pictured those big eyes boring into Gold as she demanded her $1,000 back. He would be so stirred by her pluck that he would get her soap sent out that day. He would fill all of Omar's orders. One could never know good fortune's spur. How many other times had despair turned out to be the first step, the bottom rung of joy? Oh, God, yes, he could feel it in his chest, the familiar swelling, this profound and ennobling exuberance reminding him once again that he was no ordinary man.
"Mr. Duval, Mr. Duval, I'd like a word with you,"
Harvey Klubach called as he tried to hurry down his back steps. Harvey limped toward him. Omar set the laundry on a broken lawn chair. Harvey wanted to know about his soap order. Not that he was having any second thoughts, he added. It was Jessie.
"You know how women are. They think everything's a risk."
Omar told of a warehouse so busy the trucks waited all day in long lines to be filled. He told of a company parking lot jam-packed with the expensive cars of loyal but exhausted employees.
"It's just too much success, too much good fortune all at once," he said.
Now, as he was describing Roy Gold's estate with its serpentine brick walls and glowing ponds, he realized that Jessie stood in the doorway above them, listening, her soft mouth parted.
"Is he married?"
she asked with that hesitation he found so touching in women.
"No,"
he said with a rueful smile. "All that good fortune and no one to share it with."
"That's sad, isn't it?"
she sighed.
"Not necessarily," Harvey said with a reproving glance.
"Well, I think it is," she said. "Not that my opinion matters, of course."
"Looks like you got some sun today," Harvey said, turning his back on his wife.
Omar touched his neck, surprised to find the skin so prickly and hot. He'd spent the afternoon at the lake consoling Bernadette while he tried to keep an eye on Mary and Noelle. It just wasn't fair, she'd sobbed, explaining that the ring had been bought with proceeds from the very break-in Kyle had gone to prison for, an irony that for Omar only further justified his possession of it now. When they got back from the lake, he'd tried to make her feel a little better by explaining how an item with any weight to it might end up in the sink trap, which someone with the right size wrench could open for her. She had run barefoot down the alley to use the phone in the fruit store to call Kyle's brother, Blue, to come and fish her ring out of the trap. Poor thing. It pleased him to have given her that hope, even though her ring was now an insignificant, so easily transportable by even the weakest stream that it was certainly gone forever. Jessie and Harvey's son Louis opened the door and called to his mother for ice cream, his eyes fixed on Omar.
"Do you know where Marie might be?"
Omar asked Jessie.
"I think they went for a ride, she and the boys," she said, adding brightly. "They should be right back."
"I noticed the table's still set. They haven't had supper yet."
His stomach was growling. "Jessie began.
They had a big fight, Louis interrupted his mother. Norm ran out, and then Benji...
Louis.
Louis,
his father echoed. And then Mrs. Vermoyle went speeding down the street in the car.
Louis, you don't know that, Jessie scolded.
She looked at Omar. I'm sure they'll be right back.
It's not easy raising children alone, Harvey said. That woman's got her hands full.
They're nice kids. Jessie looked at Omar. They really are, she said, as if to convince him.
The older boy's been difficult lately, Omar conceded.
Well, let me tell you, if they were mine, they'd be towing the mark. I'd have them out there right now fixing that place up.
Harvey waved his arms in disgust.
No excuse for that, none at all.
Harvey, I can't believe you're saying this.
Well, it's the truth. It's so bad every neighbor on this street's...
Harvey Klubach, shut your mouth, Jessie cried. Just shut it right now. Harvey stared at his wife in astonishment.
Look, there they are,
Louis called over the deafening rumble turning into the driveway. It was an old pea-green car that couldn't have had a muffler. A coil of rope held one side of the front bumper in place. What at first appeared to be mud splatters were actually rust pox. Norm drove with Marie beside him and Benji in the back seat. It was almost midnight, and Marie's hands were still shaking. Last week, Norm had taken $50 from his savings account to buy a car, a 49 Chevy, from a man he worked with. She hadn't known about it until tonight, when she told him she had to borrow money from him after all. She needed it for the late loan payment, as well as for this month's. Because he hadn't dared tell her, he'd been keeping the car at Weeb's house. Every night, when she thought he was visiting Weeb, whose legs were in casts, he'd actually been driving his junk of a car around town. She'd told him that he couldn't keep the car. He had to get the money back. That was impossible, he'd said. The car was already registered in his name. Impossible, she'd cried, almost insane with rage and panic. Nothing, nothing in this world was impossible. She'd demanded that Norm call the man and tell him he wanted his money back. He refused. He couldn't.
What's the man's name?
She'd picked up the phone.
Mom, please.
What's his name?
Bob Hersey. But you can't...
Bob Hersey?
She'd known him as a kid. Well, that idiot has another think coming if he thinks he's going to pawn that piece of junk off on my son, she'd panted as she flipped frenziedly through the phone book, ripping half the pages. She'd get the money back, goddammit. Why was she humiliating him like this? Norm had groaned as she dialed. After Hersey had gotten over his initial confusion, he said he was sorry, but he'd already spent Norm's money to buy another car. He'd still been talking when she slammed down the phone.
Now you've done it with your selfishness, with your stupidity, she'd screamed at Norm.
Jesus, Mom, I have to work with him. I could lose my job,
Norm had said in a high, shaky voice.
Lose your job? Thanks to you, we're going to lose our home.
Home?
He'd laughed, tears running down his work-grimed cheeks.
This isn't a home. It's a nut house, and I'm getting the hell out. Go, and keep on going.
She'd yelled through the front door as he stalked down the street, his head hanging, his pant legs and sneakers green with grass clippings. Benji had run after Norm, begging him to come back, and then she was speeding down the street after the two of them, the car bucking as she took the corner on squealing tires, with all the neighbors at their windows watching Marie Vermoyle's life fall apart faster and faster, like some crazy spinning top that would not stop until it had disintegrated. Her car had broken down on Main Street. She still had a year of payments on it. The transmission was gone, and there was no money to fix it, she was explaining now to Omar. They sat on the couch, the television on, the volume barely audible for privacy. Benji and Norm had gone to bed, and as usual, Alice still wasn't home.
Have faith, Marie,
Omar whispered.
Please.
Faith,
she gasped, laughing. She couldn't help it. Faith? Faith in what? Everything she'd ever tried to believe in had failed. Her marriage, her kids, her house, her car. She was even doing such a lousy job at work, she wouldn't be surprised if Mr. Briscoe let her go. And now the franchise was a disaster. So what was left? Did he have any ideas? He sighed, his face buried in his hands, the light from the television flickering over them.
I'm sorry, Marie. This is all my fault. If you hadn't believed in me, if you hadn't listened to me, then you wouldn't be in this dilemma.
Dilemma?
She cried, throwing her head back on the couch.
No, disaster, Omar. This is a full-fledged, out-and-out disaster. He looked at her.
I'm sorry. I don't know what else to say.
She knew that wasn't fair. He'd tried to help when no one else even cared. But she was tired now, too drained for this. He was trying to explain it all again, how they'd bought into the business right at the boom, and now with such a massive glut of orders.
I know, she said. You told me, but I'm tired. I am so, so tired.
She stood up, and he reached for her hand.
Marie,
he said in a choked voice. Let them take the house, the car, she thought. Let Alice go hide in a convent, if that's what she was up to. It had to be a hell of a lot simpler life than this one. Norm could have his shit box of a car and his beer and his brawls, and Benji, oh God, she had to be strong, had to. Why was Omar rubbing her finger like that? He was trying to work a ring over her knuckle. The stone glittered in the dim light. She held it close to her face. Peering at it, she asked what it was, though there could be no doubt. It was a diamond.
An engagement ring, he said.
She looked at him.
An engagement ring, she repeated numbly.
Yes, he said, nodding and smiling up at her. That's exactly what it is.
Later, as Omar sat on the edge of her bed, putting on his socks, her voice moved through the darkness like the blades of the tiller he'd walked behind as a child, watching the sweat plaster his father's dun-colored undershirt to his puny back, and all the time his father's voice dragging him along, shallow and dead like the earth he turned spring after spring, promising magnificent harvests that were in the end no more than enough bushels of beets and carrots and corn to get them through another gray winter. One morning when he was 14, he just up and left. And all along the way until now, he'd moved through what he felt was the fine clarity of his intuition, his imagination, and great foresight. Throughout his passage, he'd always emerged unscathed from misfortune. So great did he believe his promise and vision to be that after all these years he still hadn't reconciled the disorder and the poverty of his youth with that brilliance he believed life held out to him. He sat here now, shocked by what he'd just done. The ring he'd taken to sell had become a marriage proposal, a jail sentence. In moments like this, futility doused his soul like a sudden powerful rain. He was getting old, his feet swelling in the heat, the strangle of phlegm rising to choke him as he slept. His eyes were rheumy and pink-lidded. He was tired. But maybe he could do this, could lie down on this thin bed night after night. He could mow the lawn and paint this house, maybe sell soap out of the garage. After a while, he might even rent space downtown and get into hardware. He'd always believed in hardware. All across this great country, men were building porches, tool sheds, garages. And if not, they would soon be dreaming of building something as they picked up one of Duval's miracle ratchet wrenches. Oh, he could just picture it. To hang on their workshop pegboard. Yes, he could do it. He could stay here and never leave. She switched on the light, and his eyes stung.
It's beautiful, she whispered.
She held up her hand.
But I don't know how the kids are going to take it.
Just you be patient now, he whispered, leaning back to pat her cheek. Let's just make sure the time's right. Let's wait.
Wait? Wait for what?
She started to sit up.
Till the soap comes, he said. Then maybe they'll have a little more faith in me.
He stood up and looked down at her.
And I'll have a little more faith in me, too.
Rini had called someone who knew someone at the new paper goods plant, and Sam had been hired third shift. It hadn't taken him long to hate the job. He found it demeaning. Every night as he walked to work in these dingy green coveralls and rubber-soled boots, there was a knot in his stomach. Educated men did not wear coveralls and boots that squeaked with every step. He had read everything F. Scott Fitzgerald had ever written. Here he was, a toilet paper loader, and there was nothing about love and life and beauty he did not know, did not contemplate here on top of this yellow loader, its wide rubber track vibrating so that his teeth clattered as it rumbled back and forth between the steel ramp and the conveyor belt that carried the enormous cartons into the warehouse, where they would be loaded onto trucks in the morning. He threw the loader into neutral, then paused, staring at the hundreds of cartons piled to the mesh ceiling. It would take all night. No,
The way to look at it was in stages, parts of things, fragments. The whole did not exist. There was only here, only this moment, the shifting gears, the first carton, the next carton. One wall cleared, then the other, one step at a time, one foot in front of the other.
You are your own meager invention, Sam Fermoyle.
He backed up, shifted, rumbled toward the nearest stack. He was thinking of Alice, thin-faced now and resentful, when once she'd been such a sweet child. When he carried her, she used to hold on by slipping her hand down the back of his shirt collar. His children would punish him now. They grew older, more powerful. They could destroy him now, could walk right out of his life when he needed them most, more than he had ever needed them before. He would have to make them understand. What? That it hadn't been his fault. That he had been afraid. That he could never face the wholeness because it always seemed so grim, so pointless, when failure was the only certainty, the one true wholeness of which he was capable. No, 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 no. That was the trouble with this job. Too quiet, too much time to think. Suddenly he was afraid. His hand felt instinctively for the ignition. Turn it off if he wanted. Walk right out of here. He could find a pint or a nip somewhere. Any time, day or night, he could find some, if he wanted, whatever he wanted. That was the trouble. Everyone laughing. A 100%, 100-proof riot, Sam Fermoyle. All his life trying to make people laugh. Couldn't stand sadness, even hated daylight because of the way it magnified sadness. Water splashing in the bathroom, bacon frying, the brilliant glare of noon, the harshness, the boredom. The dinner hour building, the holocaust of their scorn, their disappointment. Pass the butter, please. Eyes on the plate, the tension weakening him. And when he could not make them laugh or love him, settling for pity. His teeth ached, rotted in his head. When he yawned or coughed, he could even smell them. When he had talked to the plant manager about the job, he'd held his hand to his mouth. The manager came right out with it and asked if he'd tried AA. Tried everything, he'd said, grinning, briefly forgetting the teeth. Tried AA and God and Sterno and straitjackets, and I'm just going to try me. The manager had looked away, hadn't laughed. Why the hell should he? His first break came at 3 a.m. The night watchman came into the storeroom and offered him a cigarette. A bandy-legged old fellow with bright eyes and the white fuzz of unshaven whiskers, he glanced slyly from Sam to the door he had just bolted.
They don't allow smoking in here, he wheezed. But I'm careful enough.
He held out a tin can of swollen cigarette butts floating in brown water that served as an ashtray. Sam turned down the cigarette. He'd rather go outside and smoke alone.
So you're the new loader,
the old man said, taking a deep drag.
I'm the new loader, he said,
anxious to get back up onto the machine and start the engine. He didn't like the empty sounds of the factory, the creak of wood, the persistent clanging somewhere of a pipe, the hiss of steam.
A quick one,
the old man was saying, sucking his gums, holding out the half pint of blackberry brandy.
Go ahead.
He shook his head, climbing quickly back onto the loader, turning it on. The motor roared and shimmied, its rumble oddly comforting. The old man tilted the bottle back, closing his eyes as he drank. When he was done, he wiped his mouth with the back of his hand and blinked, eyes glistening as if he were on fire inside. Dying and alive, Sam knew. He looked away, afraid. It fizzed in his brain like flashing bulbs, like anger, hunger, this thirst, this need, this painless death where the mourners round the beer offered total absolution.
He was drunk.
What did he know?
Right. He knows not what he does. He didn't mean it.
Chorus to his mother's dying litany. He didn't mean it. I know he ripped apart your lawn and knocked down your brand new fence and smashed up your son's car, impregnated your 18-year-old daughter, spit in your face, stole the rents, hurled a bottle through the movie screen, set your newspaper on fire while you were reading it, passed out and vomited at his own sister's desperate and pitiful wedding, has never lasted a full year at any job, has cheated,
and lied, hastened the death of his father, has struck his wife, resented not only his children's needs but their existence as well, their very being, each birth terrifying him, diminishing him. But he didn't mean it. You see, he was drunk. Such power he had when he was drunk. That was it, he thought, seeing the old man shuffle through the door, like someone who's dying, his mother or a sick child. Read to me, play with me, sing to me. Don't go. I'm afraid of the dark. If you leave me, something terrible will happen. At least leave the door open. Marie was the only one left. One by one, they had tired of him. All his life, there had been no end of people anxious to rehabilitate him, pick up the pieces, sober him up, forgive him. You were drunk. You didn't mean it. I didn't mean it. He called Marie today to tell her about his job, but her reaction had been disappointing. Her voice was different. The edge was gone. The nervous little tremble in her words, the caring, the hope, the sorrow had been replaced by boredom, annoyance. He had become a nuisance. He thought he heard her yawn.
I'm a changed man,
he'd whispered into the phone. What else is new, she might as well have said. She told him she didn't have much time. She was in the middle of something. She hung up. She didn't need him anymore, weak or strong. She just didn't need him. There would be only Helen left, waiting, reeling him in, closer each time, the line fraying and thinning, her lure, that money, as she devoted her life to his doom. And it was funny, really. As a child, he had adored her, been desperate for her love, had leaped from trees and the pitched roof of the shed, screaming, "Look, Helen, look!" Actually, he'd had two mothers, the crimp-souled, stiff-eyed older sister, plain and sharp-tongued, without love or humor, determined that he would have the upbringing she had endured. And the mother, mellowed enough by time and frustration, and recognizing in her spinster daughter the folly of prayers, parsimony, and manners, allowing her late-born son every whim in the name of love, celebrating him, always looking the other way, and when he was in trouble she would weep at the thought that he might have been offended or injured by his accuser. The sun had scoured its way through the high, sooty windows of the storeroom. It was 6 o'clock. Four empty walls. He was done. All of the hundreds of cartons moved on to the loading platform, ready for shipment. It was over. He walked home, exhilarated by the sweetness of damp, curling grass and cool asphalt. Windows were open in the houses he passed. He could smell bacon frying. A baby cried. Ahead, the milk truck rattled from stop to stop. The milkman dashed up each front walk, the glass bottles jiggling in his metal carrier. At one house, a woman stooped through the open door, reaching for her newspaper, clutching the front of her bathrobe, aluminum curlers bobbing from her head. She saw him, stepped quickly back, and closed the door. He smiled, rounded the corner home. From her window, Helen watched uneasily, peering down at his jaunty gait, alert for any sign that he had been drinking again. Rini put the cat in the basement.
I won't be gone too long, he called as he turned the deadbolt.
The cat meowed against the door.
You be a good Tom now, and when I get back we'll have us a nice big lunch.
He'd seen Mr. Cushing's car pull into the lot across the street 2 hours ago, but it had taken all this time to work up his courage. This was the fourth morning in a row he'd locked Tom in the cellar, then stood by the front door with a ledger under his arm. All his years of faithful record-keeping, all the times he'd rushed out to help another old woman who'd slipped and fallen on the ice in Cushing's lot, not to mention all the cars he'd jump-started over there, all the door locks he'd fished open with his specially fashioned coat hanger, and this was his reward. To have the golden toasty line stolen right out from under his nose. No, sir, it just wasn't fair. He was past the depression and the brooding, and now he was just plain mad. He marched out the door, but the minute he was on the sidewalk, he wanted to run back inside. He took a deep breath. He had to do this. He crossed the street.
Floor, please, inquired Arlo,
Cushing's elevator boy, as he pulled the door shut. Arlo wasn't a boy, but an old man, a contemporary of Patrick Cushing's. Arlo had started as Cushing's delivery boy. Through the years, he had served in almost every position Cushing's offered. Now, the same driver who brought Mr. Cushing to work also picked up Arlo.
"Mr. Cushing's office. Whatever floor's that," answered Reenie.
Sweat ran down his temples.
"That would be 4, sir," said Arlo, his back turned. 4th door on the right."
They stared up at the brass arrow, inching its way from 2 to 3 to 4. Reenie walked slowly down the narrow corridor, counting the doors. He knocked and was surprised when the old man opened the door himself. Muttering for Reenie to close the door, he shuffled back to his paper-strewn desk. Reenie sat in the stiff chair facing him. He was disappointed to find the office so small and ordinary. There was no massive credenza, no wet bar, just 4 tall filing cabinets. The only picture, indeed the only color in the room, was a small photograph of Mr. Cushing's daughter, Nora, and her son, both waving from the deck of a ship.
"Yes, yes, of course. Reenie LeChance,"
the old man interrupted Reenie's stammered introduction.
"And I know exactly what you're here to tell me,"
he said, leaning over the desk, unmindful of the dried oatmeal on his tie.
"You do?"
Reenie said, hopeful for a moment. The golden toasty salesman must have told Mr. Cushing how important this was to him.
"I've been waiting all morning for someone to face me, and not one single man in this town has had the guts to, not one. Until you came through that door, I've been sitting here stewing away and mad as hell. But more than I'm mad, I'm ashamed. Some people moan and groan how if only old Judge Clay was here, he'd set people straight. He'd get it all back on track. But I tell you, things are too far gone for that anymore. It's a good thing the judge doesn't have to live through this. I'll tell you, it'd break his heart all he did for this town. And look what they do. They vote to evict his best friend, a blind man."
He realized Mr. Cushing was talking about Joey Selden, the old popcorn man.
"It's shameful, that's what it is," Cushing railed. "Everybody figures good luck to the other guy because they've got their own ass to cover. Nobody can take anything on face value all of a sudden. It's all why? When I was a boy, if I asked my father why, the answer was because I said so. But now the old orthodoxies aren't enough anymore. Authority doesn't mean a damn. Sometimes it's enough to do something just because it's right to do. Why? Because. Just simply because."
He banged his fist on the desk.
"You know what I mean, do you, Reenie?"
Reenie nodded. Though he didn't know what orthodoxies were, there was in his breast this stirring that rose with the force of the old man's passion. For once in his life, come hell or high water, he would speak his mind.
"Of course you do. That's why I'm not one bit surprised you're here."
Mr. Cushing peered up at him.
"You're not like the rest of them, are you? You're a man that walks alone and thinks his own thoughts. And believe me, Reenie, there aren't many of us around anymore."
Reenie's hand closed over the ledger's rough binding.
"Mr. Cushing," he said, "you see, the reason I came is to tell you something. You see, for a long time I've been trying to get this one line, well, maybe not trying for that whole time, I mean, that I did really in the last 6 months. Try, I mean, you know, painting the whole place and sprucing things up. But way long before that, I always had this idea, you know, of being a golden toasty dealer. And now I can't."
Mr. Cushing had been looking at him.
"I would say not," he said.
A hardness rose in his features. He listened as Reenie recounted the 33 long-distance telephone calls he'd made to Golden Toasty in the last year and a half, the 6 letters, the ads he'd clipped from magazines and studied so closely he knew them by heart. He told of meeting the young salesman and how impressed he was with him, the tuna fish sandwich, how keenly he'd sensed the admiration of the other diners in the booths, and how he'd probably put too much pressure on the young man, especially insisting on the extra sandwich, and then how he'd read to him from the ledger. He described the ledgers and the years of record-keeping, the accumulation of statistics he'd always wanted to share with Mr. Cushing, but had never known how until now. So here they were, one book anyway. Reenie opened the ledger. He took a deep breath, then began to read.
May 14, rainy, noon, 59 degrees, 31 shoppers, 5:30 p.m., 46 shoppers.
He turned the next few pages, reading random dates. Mr. Cushing was staring at him. He obviously didn't understand. Reenie explained that he was the one who had informed the Golden Toastie salesman that Cushing's didn't sell small appliances, and how he had been able to tell him how many shoppers used Cushing's rear entrance on any given day.
I told him probably double that many used the front,
Reenie added.
Actually, it's the back that's busiest because of the parking I've got. But the rest of the stores aren't so lucky. But I told them. I warned them. You remember, don't you, Reenie? I said, go ahead and meter Merchants Row, you damn fools, and watch what happens.
Cushing pulled the ledger close and began to read various entries aloud.
November 26, light snow, 29 degrees, 236 shoppers from morning to night. Day after Thanksgiving, first day of Christmas shopping. This is amazing. This is really something.
He looked up and grinned.
This reminds me of the old days, Reenie, when people really cared about business. Ah!
He waved disgustedly.
Now all they care about is putting in their 40 hours and demanding more benefits than the small business can afford to keep shelling out. I tell you, it's a losing game we're playing, Reenie. A losing game.
Mr. Cushing, you can't take the Golden Toastie line away from me. You just can't,
he gasped. The room was so still he could hear Mr. Cushing's stomach gurgle.
It's not that way at all,
the old man tried to explain. The Golden Toastie man had approached him. It was the American way. Golden Toastie had been aggressive enough to go looking for new markets.
Because of me, he cried. Because of them ledgers there. Because I'm the one that told him you don't sell small appliances. Reenie, what can I say? We're businessmen. It's competition. There's room for both of us.
But you don't even have an appliance department, Reenie cried, his voice breaking.
Well, yes, I do,
Mr. Cushing said softly.
As a matter of fact, we're in the process of starting one up. It's the only way to fight the shopping mall competition. We've got to be a full-service store.
Reenie nodded. He didn't know what to say or do. Everything felt alien. Even the ledger book open between them was no longer his. Every extrapolation of weather, commerce, and his feelings diminished now by his rashness, his foolishness in coming here. He stood up and reached for the ledger.
I'll tell you what I need, Reenie. I need a manager for the new department, a man who knows the different lines, someone that thinks like me. I'll tell you the truth, Reenie, all these years, ever since my daughter's humiliation, I couldn't stand that Fermoil family, especially Bridget and all her heirs. But I noticed how she never took to you, and there again that told me something. You're a man of principle, aren't you, Reenie? You could be a real help to me, Reenie. I'm just getting slower and slower. My daughter doesn't care about the business except for how it supports her. There's only the one grandson, and he's dying,
he said with a wave of dismissal. The old man opened his desk drawer and pulled out a crumpled handkerchief. He blew his nose, then wiped tears from his eyes.
Do you think you'd be interested, Reenie?
Reenie couldn't stop grinning. It was a dream come true, working with other people, supervising other workers. Helen would be so proud. People everywhere would know him. He would get Marie's children any job they wanted in town. But then he remembered Tom. What would he do with him? There was no place for Tom to go.
No, he said. I can't.
Why?
Mr. Cushing asked.
Because, he stammered. Because my cat has to live in the store, because my wife hates animals.
And I hate cats, Reenie, said Mr. Cushing. It's the one animal I can't stand.
Rini was turning his closed sign to open when Robert Haddad came to the store. The insurance agent wanted to buy his wife an electric mixer, the fanciest model Rini had.
"This here's the best one, Mixmade," he said, sliding a heavy white mixing set from the shelf.
He blew dust from the box as he carried it to the counter.
"It's got your four different sized bowls," he said, tearing it all from the box.
His hands could not work fast enough. He had to make this sale before Haddad heard about Cushing's new appliance department.
"Your three different sized beaters, your special dough thing here," he said, holding up the rectangular steel paddle. "Your wife make bread?" he asked doubtfully.
Mrs. Haddad sure didn't look like a lady that made bread.
"Well, let's put it this way. She's going to be making a lot of dough," he laughed. "Then maybe she ought to have more the commercial mixer,"
Rini said, crestfallen. He didn't sell commercial mixers.
"This here ain't going to give her the volume for a lot of dough."
"No, no, Rini, it was a joke."
Haddad rolled his eyes and sighed. His wife was going to sell soap at parties. The mixer was a surprise. He was hoping to get her interested in cooking and baking.
"Then this'll do it," Rini cried with relief. "See, it's got your seven different speeds, all the way from high whip to slow blend. Your automatic beater ejection."
He pushed a button on the side.
"How much?" asked Haddad.
$39.99, he said.
Haddad whistled.
"That's expensive. I can go up to Monkey Ward's and get one half that price. But the thing is, I'd rather keep my business downtown." "But they're not going to be selling Mixmade," Rini said. "That's the thing. This here's a quality mixer. Listen to this," he said, turning on the mixer.
The beaters spun to a silver blur in the clear glass bowl. Rini moved the dial from speed to speed, his spirits climbing. He looked up to see Haddad standing by the cellar door.
"What's down here? Storage?" he asked, opening the door. "Jesus Christ!"
He jumped back, startled to see Tom pass in front of him. Tom sprang onto the counter.
"I don't keep much inventory," Rini said, stroking the cat's rippling back as it curled against him.
Haddad didn't like Tom, and the cat could tell.
"I sell off the floor," Rini explained. "Keeps things simple that way, huh?"
Haddad asking, peering down the dark stairs.
"Yeah, so I don't get stuck with 10 models of last year's washing machine," Rini boasted.
Of course, he couldn't afford to buy 10 models in the first place, but Cushing's would be able to. Soon, when his customers didn't see the model they wanted, they'd only have to cross the street for it.
"Yeah, I know what you mean," Haddad sighed,
returning to the counter, where he stood back away from the cat.
"I'm at the point now. I don't even trust banks. Everything's so controlled and regulated." "Me neither,"
Rini agreed with a vigorous nod.
"The way I figure it, they're going to spy on me. I'm just going to have to play it a little closer to the vest, that's all."
He winked and patted his back pocket.
"You know what I'm saying, right?" "Yeah, yeah," Rini cried,
grateful for the camaraderie.
"You have to," Haddad said. "They don't give you any other choice."
He looked around.
"I got a place, a box right in the store for certain transactions." "Cash," he muttered,
clearing his throat behind his hand.
"If you know what I mean." "Me too," Rini laughed. "Mine's under the rug. I just lift up a floorboard," confided Haddad. "Mine's down,"
he caught himself, his eyes on the cellar door.
"I almost forgot. You want the mix made?"
Haddad said he did, but the problem was it was just too expensive. Rini offered to knock $5 off the price, them both being fellow downtown merchants.
$34.99,
he said, as the cat jumped off the counter, its thick paws meeting the floor in a soft thud.
"I'll tell you what," Haddad said, moving out of the cat's way. "Things are slow so far this week. Give me a few more days and I'll be in." "Sure thing," Rini said. "I'll even put your name on it."
He was still printing Robert Haddad on the empty box when the door closed.
"The trick is," Rini instructed the cat,
who had jumped back onto the counter and sat watching him,
to be flexible and not be afraid to give a little.
Tom began to purr. Reenie smiled, and the purring grew louder and louder. It filled the store, the streets outside, like a great engine churning out such longing that he could barely walk. He locked the front door, then staggered into the bathroom, into the reek of glossy heat, his ears ringing, ring, ring, ringing, while just outside the door the cat purred as he waited, yearning for a woman's voice to answer, to speak to him.
Hello?
Oh, hello.
He closed his eyes. This one was new. She'd come into the store last week looking at stoves.
Hello, you beautiful thing, you.
Oh, Lord, listen to you.
She laughed nervously.
It's you I like to listen to. Your voice is so sweet. It's sweet, sweet as honey.
Lord.
She sounded different.
And you got beautiful skin. It looks like there's dew on it, you know, like on grass first thing in the morning.
The pause came like a flutter in the silence.
Do I know you?
No.
Then why are you calling me?
Because I like to talk to you.
But I've never talked to you before.
Is this Mrs. Brewster?
No.
Well, who are you then?
I'm not going to tell you. What do you want to know for?
I just want to talk to you.
Why? Don't you have anyone else to talk to? A wife, a girlfriend, somebody?
No.
Well, I really can't talk. My baby's awake.
Oh, I'm sorry. You go take care of the baby.
She's crying.
Then you gotta go.
Don't you have any friends?
He paused to think.
Not really. I know people, but not like friends, you know.
Can you hold on a minute while I get the baby?
Yes. Oh, yes, I can hold. You go get the baby.
When she came back, she was out of breath. She said she was in the kitchen warming a bottle. He could hear the soft cooing. He pictured her jiggling the baby on her hip while she stood in front of the stove watching the water boil under the bottle.
How old's the baby?
7.5 months.
What's her name?
Kathy Jean. That's K with an I dash small j.
Kathy Jean. He told her that was a beautiful name. She thanked him and said her husband's family didn't like it, but then they didn't like her either, so she guessed it didn't really matter. When he asked her why they didn't like her, she said it was a long story, but basically it was because she had thrown him out last year, 2 months before the baby was born.
Why'd you do that?
He could hear a wooden chair scraping over the floor.
There. That's better. I'm sitting down now. Ooh, she can't wait, the little pig.
She asked him if he could hear her sucking. He said no, and so she held the phone to the baby's mouth.
Did you hear it?
She asked, coming back on.
Yes.
He laughed, overwhelmed with giddiness.
Yes, it was so loud, I...
She's such a little pig. I just hope she's skinny as her father. He's like a beanpole.
Why'd you do that? Make him leave?
He asked to avoid having to mispronounce throw as tro the way he usually did.
Because he's a bum. The whole time we were together, he never stopped seeing all his old girlfriends, so I just got sick of it.
Why'd you marry him?
'Cause I was PG.
PG?
Pregnant. What, you never heard of that? Geez, here I am with an obscene phone caller, and I'm doing all the talking.
I'm not an obscene phone caller.
Yes, you are. You said you call ladies you don't even know, and you say things, right?
Yeah, but never bad things.
Well, what kind of things, then?
There was a catch in her voice, an eagerness. He shrugged and closed his eyes, ashamed of all the glistening breasts and parted thighs, the lush mounds of kinky hair.
Well?
Just mostly things about them. Like what pretty eyes they got, and things like that.
I got hazel eyes and long eyelashes, dark like my hair. My hair's brunette, but some people say black, it's so dark. Hello, you still there?
Yeah,
he said, grinning.
I'm still here.
Okay, so now you tell me something. Tell me something about you.
I got brown eyes and brown hair,
he said, touching the sparse strands on the back of his head. She asked if he was tall.
He said he wasn't tall and he wasn't short, just kind of regular. He told her about riddles and about Tom and all the animals he'd grown up with on his father's farm in Quebec. He told her about his father and the little he could recall of his mother, the warm cream she would pour over his oatmeal, and the way she patted water up her throat and rosy cheeks on hot days. He told her things he hadn't thought of in years, the go-kart his father made him, then let him help paint red, the torture to speak English in school when his brain worked in French. He'd had a lucky charm, a rabbit's foot, that his mother said would let the English words slide over his tongue.
Do you still have it?
No. I gave it to a girl. Her name was Soli. She was the first girl I ever kissed.
What a sap!
She laughed, and now he laughed with her. There was so much he had forgotten. Once there had been another life than this, happier, hopeful. There had been a playful boy, a shy, romantic young man. Once he had been loved. There had been friends, the two Bryan boys up the road. They called him Bobo. He had worn black boots and a leather jacket with a sheepskin collar. One day a girl named Edith had ridden on his bike, her arms around his waist, her cheek against his back.
Oh, jeez. She just spit up all over the place. It's running down my arm, even. Call me back in a few minutes, okay?
Yeah, he said. I will, I will.
Her phone clicked.
Wait, he shouted into the buzzing receiver. I don't know your number. I don't know your name. I don't know who you are, he cried. After so